Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini in the Instax Mini 7 and the Instax Mini 25, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Photo Publicist, providing worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development for the photographer, turning photographers into celebrities. You can find out more information over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the highest quality work known to mankind anywhere on this planet. Unbelievable developing, scanning, and of course, output on high quality Fuji Crystal Archive. Unbelievable cool stuff these guys are up to. And remember, you don't have a photograph unless you have a print in your hand, and you need to print your pictures. This is important. You need to supply proofs to your customers and even print your own work, because it's not about looking at it on a monitor. It's about holding a print in your hand. Definitely check these guys out at Richard Photo Lab, of course, at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5. DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.dr5.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com for the camera strap that will not slip off your shoulder, guaranteed bar none, the coolest strap around. Our friends at Iger Studios for the finest quality drum scans known to mankind, igerstudios.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be here with Evan Baines. Evan is an unbelievable commercial, advertising, portrait, and wedding photographer, and his work at all levels rocks. Evan was just featured on our buddy's website. That's right, over at Mamiya, highlighted his work. You know, he shoots with an RZ and a Mamiya 7 rangefinder. He shoots beautiful weddings, southern weddings. You know, Evan is in Tennessee. People in the South love to have formal bridal portraits, and Evan does fabulous work, really, and his background is incredible. Ex-Special Forces Green Beret. How he got in photography is incredible. His outlook on photography is incredible. And his knowledge of fine art and traditional art and how it really helped him and changed his outlook. And that's something that everybody should do, is study past photographers, current photographers, and even more so, old school artists, the old Dutch masters. You will learn so much by just reading and looking. And of course, Evan talks about that today himself, how he got into photography, his work, and really check out his website, Evan Baines, EvanBaines.com. While you're listening to the interview, go check out Evan's website. Fabulous work, I'm telling you. This is no slouch here. This guy's hooked up and he's got it cooking, and you can learn a lot from Evan. Very inspirational, beautiful photography. And guess what? This all ties together. What is his favorite medium of capture? Guess what? Film. There you go. Back to film again. Why? Everybody loves film. You know, he shoots digital too. Most of you guys do, probably. 5D Mark II, D3S, 1D Mark IV. Who knows? Sigma, SD14, Sony. Who knows? Olympus. It's great. Whatever. But you know something? It all ties back together with film. People love analog photography. Evan loves analog photography, and you should check out his new body of personal work. This is great stuff. Evan, how you doing today?
I'm hanging in there pretty good.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program to talk about yourself. your photography and all the great stuff you're up to. Thanks for joining us, buddy.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So, Evan, let's talk about yourself as a photographer. Tell me, did you get the bug as a photographer when you were a kid in high school, chasing girls? What got you to say, you know something, I want to take pictures of people and cool stuff?
Well, I was always an artsy kid growing up. I'd done a lot of watercolors and a bunch of different visual arts, but absolutely never picked up a camera throughout most of my young life. I was enlisted in the U.S. military in the 5th Special Forces Group, and I was trained in surveillance photography, which was actually the first time I picked up a camera of any note, which was a Nikon D200, if I remember. And it became a hobby on the side while I was still in the service. And then when I got out of the service, it was something that rapidly grew into a lot more than a hobby.
Pretty cool to get that kind of training actually in the service. I mean, chief takeaway, a lot of cool stuff there. So
I have a lot of diverse skills that I can bring to bear in my business and my artwork.
So at one point, you get out of the service, you're a free man again. Is it like, I want to just keep taking pictures? I want to go off and join a private security company in Iraq? I mean, what do you do? What made you say, I want to go take pictures of pretty girls and weddings?
Well, the way I got started, actually, I was back in school, and the first real lens that I got, the first serious lens for my Canon 10D, which was my first camera that I got from my father-in-law, was the Canon 100 macro. And I wound up looking for small things to take pictures of, just because I wanted to play with my new lens, and I wound up raiding my wife's jewelry drawer. And I started taking pictures of all the different jewelry that we'd gotten her over the years. And a lot of the stuff that I'd gotten for her was custom jewelry from a local jewelry designer. Wound up showing him some of the shots, and he was impressed, and he hired me to start doing more. It's really kind of a weird way to start in photography, because jewelry photography is about as difficult technically as anything that you could start with. But that's how I got my start in professional photography.
Are you a natural light guy? Are you a flash guy? I mean, how did you actually light this jewelry to be able to get someone to say, hey, I want to pay you to do some of this?
The jewelry stuff, I was shooting in a frosted white Tupperware bin with a whole bunch of different CFL daylight balanced bulbs that I'd bought on eBay. So it was all continuous light and gradually getting more and more complex with the different light sources. And starting to take the jewelry out of the bin sometimes and using different reflectors and gobos, but all of it very, very improvisational, gradually getting to the point where it was approaching a professional quality. I mean, certainly some of the early stuff was pretty dicey in retrospect, but it was good enough, and I was probably also working pretty cheap. It was certainly better than he was getting with his point and shoot.
Let me ask you this. So with all the training that you've had in the military and some extensive training beyond the normal foot soldier, have you found any of that to come into play that actually has helped your photography besides the initial instruction of here's how to take some reconnaissance photos?
Well, certainly a good trigger pull on a rifle and a good click of the shutter. I can handhold a pretty low shutter speed, we'll put it that way. But more importantly than that, I would say that the biggest thing I got out of it in terms of my documentary is really understanding ideas of how to blend in and how to be discreet, which I think is something very important and very misunderstood by a lot of photographers. Just like in the military, you have these guys who think that they can put on a ghillie suit and walk in downtown and they're going to be discreet, and it just makes them stand out more. And the same is true for a lot of photographers. I mean, especially with the wedding photographers, you'll see everybody's wearing all black with a black ski mask and tiptoeing around a room, jumping out of corners, thinking that's their idea of being discreet. And one of the things that I learned in the military about camouflage from driving a 1970 beaten-up Cutlass Sierra taxi around northern Iraq is do what everybody else is doing, and that's the way to be discreet, and that's the way to blend in. So if I'm going into a room where everybody's sitting down, I want to try to find a way to sit down too. I don't want to be the only guy standing because everybody will start looking at me. Similarly, as far as what people are wearing, if you want to blend in, wear what everybody else is wearing. Don't wear jet black ninja suits. So those are definitely some lessons that I've applied to the way I do my photography.
It's common sense, right? Blend in the environment. Don't look like you stand out.
Yeah, and it's also about economy of motion. If you plan out your actions in advance and you rehearse them mentally and try to find a way to do whatever you're going to do with a minimum amount of movement, that will make you attract less attention than if you're sort of jerky and trying to do things quickly. So the idea of an economy of motion is also very important and something I got out of the military.
Wow, great tip. So you're out of the military, you're shooting beautiful jewelry. When did you decide, I want to take pictures of people, because you have a diverse portfolio, and we'll get into some of your other personal projects that you're working on here. But if you go to your website, you can look at some of this beautiful wedding and portrait stuff that's going on. And then you can go look at some really cool product photography as well. So there's a unique mix of different things here going on. So how did this stuff evolve?
Well, actually, one of my service member friends was getting married. That was the first wedding that I shot. I don't have any of that on the website. I never did put it on the website because my colleagues tend to not like to have their pictures floating around the internet. But I shot his wedding mostly because the person that he'd hired off of Craigslist hadn't told him that they were only planning on showing up for some portraits afterwards and weren't actually going to be covering the ceremony or the pre-ceremony or pretty much any other part of the day. So I wound up impromptu shooting the bulk of the wedding work that day, and I really enjoyed it. And my wife and I had placed a great emphasis on our wedding photography, and it was something very important to us. So I thought it was a lot of fun, and it's also an opportunity to make good money shooting people. I mean, let's face it, it's kind of tough to make money as a photojournalist these days with the magazine and newspaper industries being what they are. Being a wedding photographer is a license to shoot candid photos of people on a very emotionally charged day in their lives.
Well, no, I mean, it's a great place to go shoot, right? I mean, you can do product photography, you can do details, you can do macro, you can do portraiture, you can do candid photojournalistic, you can do all these things in a matter of a few hours.
Yeah, so it's definitely something where you can apply a diverse skill set. Again, for me, it was something that was very important to my wife and I, and we had very particular ideas about what we wanted, which was really interesting because once I'd been doing wedding photography for a couple of years, I looked at my portfolio and realized that I wouldn't have hired me, which was kind of a weird feeling, because one of the dangers that I sort of feel that I fell into is that I was looking too much at what was popular and too much at what was exciting and interesting, and had completely lost sight of what actually interested me. I was just focusing on what I thought would sell. So that prompted some pretty serious soul searching a couple of years ago and pretty heavy rebrand.
Back with the wedding things, how's your posture when you're doing wedding? Because a lot of people relate wedding photography as a very stressful environment because you're there to get a certain thing and you can't do it over.
Well, nobody's shooting at me, so stress is relative.
Well, I think a lot of people look at wedding stuff and they get freaked out. It's like, okay, these events are moving, and unless you're directing a portrait session or something, or when the service is going and certain things are happening, it's almost out of the photographer's control. So I think that maybe with your background, it's a very low stress, maybe something that because of the training, it's not a stressful environment for you. Maybe it even gives you more chance to focus on that decisive moment because you're just not worried. Maybe that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, and for me, the documentary aspect is really the most important aspect of the day. And that's something, when my wife and I got married, we were absolutely adamant that we had one posed photo of just the whole group. We had a fairly small wedding. One posed photo, the entire rest of the day was exclusively photojournalism or documentary. It was all shot on black and white film. And that was something that we were absolutely adamant about. We didn't want any color and we didn't want any posed photos.
Let me ask about that. So with being introduced into photography in the service with Nikon Digital, and then you get a digital Canon from your father-in-law, why would you want to have black and white film for your gig where you were actually shooting stuff for other people on digital?
But you've got to understand, if you look at the actual timeline, though, that our wedding predated any serious interest in photography on my part. When my wife and I got married, I had never picked up a camera seriously. However, I had strong opinions about the art aspects of it and was absolutely adamant that I wanted black and white film, because I loved how black and white film looked. And then when I started getting into it as a hobby, I got started with the digital stuff. The learning curve was so fast and it was exciting. And that's where I got my start professionally. That was one of the many ways in which I sort of drifted from what really were my strong beliefs and what I really loved about photography. And it was only later that I was able to get back to that.
So let's talk about this progression of technology versus your artistic vision. I think currently you still shoot some digital, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I still do shoot some digital, but I find myself more and more, anytime I take a good digital picture, I look at it and say, boy, I wish that was on film. I wish I'd shot that on a real camera.
Right. So let's talk about that. So I know you're using a 5D Mark II. a 5D Mark II is not bad. You can shoot 3200 with it and get away. And I think there's a place in documentary coverage when it gets so dark and trying not to introduce a lot of changes in the environment with using supplemental lighting. I mean, where do you draw the point of like, okay, I want to shoot this on film, or I don't care because it's really throwaway? Is that why you use digital? Where do you draw the line aesthetically and artistically about, I want to shoot this on film, I'll just shoot this on digital, I don't care?
The truth of the matter is, yeah, shoot a 5D Mark II and a 1DS Mark III, and they're both spectacular cameras, and they both do amazingly well in low light, especially. And there are situations, certainly, where we're looking for color, that it's very, very nice to have that luxury of being able to produce a clean file with good color that'll enlarge reasonably well at ISO 3200 or even beyond in some cases. So there's a lot to be said for that, and I certainly wouldn't want to denigrate that. But for me, most of the really important work that I do, the purely technical aspects of the image are really secondary. I really think it's something that I've looked at over time. I spend a lot of time reading. I spend a lot of time studying classic photographers and photographic history. And I've developed this opinion that there are only a couple of things that can make your picture worth a darn. First and foremost, people who are good photographers and people who take good pictures either find interesting content or create interesting content. That is paramount and a common thread throughout the entire history of the medium. Then the second thing is any technique that's applied, if you want a photo to be good in a lasting sense and in a long-term sense, has to be furthering the content in some way. It has to be something that's directly related to it. A lot of people get very hung up, and something that I see a lot is that people get very hung up on technique for technique's sake. In particular, they confuse the idea of personal style with a technique or a set of techniques. Really, the only style that matters in photography, in my opinion, is an approach to content. Because I don't think there's any lighting technique or any lens technique or any camera technique that you could possibly find that is difficult and unique enough to constitute a personal style.
So how long did it take you to come and draw to this conclusion that the gear means nothing? It doesn't really matter if it's a throwaway disposable camera or a $100,000 medium format digital.
Here's the thing, the gear does matter, but not in the way that most people think. The gear does matter, not so much in terms of the pure technical quality of how many megapixels or how shallow can you get the depth of field or do you have 6.2 gigawatts of strobe lighting. But what it does matter is in terms of process. The type of equipment that you use will influence the type of content and your approach to the content. And it's something, again, that I see a lot of people when they get hung up on a particular technique as being their style. The photographers who say, well, strobing everything is my look. They've made decisions about the type of content. I mean, look, if you're carrying 60 pounds of lighting equipment, you're not going to go very far from the car, and you're not going to be terribly spontaneous. You've made decisions about the type of content that you're going to capture before you even look at the subject. I mean, you're out there in the field with your 1,200 watt second strobe and battery pack and all this stuff, and you're taking test shots, and then you're looking at the back of the camera, test shot, look at the back of the camera. And meanwhile, your subject, who's in the wedding and portrait world, isn't a professional model, is sitting there looking at their watch, and you're like, okay, just stand there, this is still just a test shot, this isn't the real photo. Okay, now, all right, now go. You're asking them to perform for you, and they're not professional models, and they can't do that. So the point is that the gear and your chasing after a certain technical look has influenced the content that you're going to get before you've even considered the content. Almost any technique or gear-driven approach is making choices about the content for you. So for me, it's not that the gear doesn't matter, but the gear matters in terms of what process it's going to give me more than in terms of the pure technical quality of how grainy the photo is or anything like that.
Okay, so let's chat about this then. So in the context of gear matters, what matters to Evan in regards to gear? Let's just talk this in general. So for your style and what you're liking at this point in your career, what gear matters to you that you think has an influence but makes you actually go through and finish this vision that you have for whatever project you're working on?
Well, for portrait work, I like waist-level viewfinders. And that's one of the reasons why I like medium format equipment. I shoot on an RZ. I like waist-level viewfinders because the subject can see my face. And that allows me to connect with the subject in a way that is very hard to do when you have a big old chunk of magnesium and plastic in between my face and theirs. So that's a very big difference, not so much in terms of just how the pictures are going to look, but in terms of the way you connect with the person in front of you and can hopefully elicit that really telling expression and make a connection. I like rangefinders because I can see outside of the frame and I can see in greater depth. If you're shooting on a SLR with a fast lens, whether it's a 2.8 or a 1.4, you're seeing the world in a very shallow slice of depth of field. And it's hard to layer your content. Layered content is one of the most important aspects of documentary photography to me. So a rangefinder allows me to layer content a little bit more. Just the size of the camera. I've gotten very averse to big cameras in general. I've taken all the grips off of my gear. And one of the reasons I've actually been shooting more on the 5D when I do shoot digital than the 1D is just purely because I feel that the 1D is a more intimidating camera to the subject, or it makes me more obtrusive.
Did you find that these thoughts in regards to the personal connection and portraiture with the waist-level viewfinder, or that you can shoot left eye open with a rangefinder, is this something that has come about because of experience, or is because you're gaining more knowledge about the history of art and the way that things are conceived with art versus just the technical aspect of using the gear?
It's a little bit of both. Certainly, my experience plays a role. The more I try different things and experiment with different things, I start to find different things that work for me. But I definitely say that a big part of my growth has come as a result of my study of photo history. And I think any serious photographer goes through their Avedon phase at this point, and I did that as well. I was absolutely fascinated at the time. I was focused on this very heavily lit style, and everything was very, very set up and structured, but very, very static. And I just fell in love with Avedon's portraits, and I spent a lot of time reading essays of people who had sat with Avedon and reading about his process and how he would stand there next to the Cynar with the shutter release cable with a view camera. He'd just have it set up, he'd pre-compose it, and then stand next to the camera and talk to the subject. He completely reduced his portraiture to just what he could elicit from the subject and what he could bring to the surface through conversation. And so I decided that I was going to do the same thing. I was shooting on an RB at the time, and I started doing what I called my Avedon sessions, where I would put somebody in front of a white background and talk to them and try to get something meaningful. And most of them were absolutely terrible portraits. But it did educate me very much on the fact that choosing a certain approach and choosing gear definitely impacts the way you relate to your subject matter.
Do you find that you've also made this process apply to your glass? And we'll talk more about this, but I know that you shoot with some 1Vs, some fabulous Canon film-based SLR. But do you find that you're shooting everything wide open, everything stopped down? Because that's an aesthetic choice that I think people go through as well.
At the beginning, I was shooting almost everything all wide open. I still do shoot wide open a reasonable amount. Lately, more and more, wherever possible, I want as much depth of field as possible. Because in a perfect world, I want there to be multiple layers of content in the foreground and the background. I've really very much been influenced by spending time studying. Robert Frank is one of my big all-time photo heroes, but also guys like Elliot Erwitt and W. Eugene Smith, and the idea of interrelated subject matter and parallelism, hiding things in the background that are going to reflect on whatever your main subject matter is. Sometimes even burying the subject, which is something most contemporary photographers are afraid to do. Everybody's so hung up on the fact that if you don't dumb it down so that anybody can immediately tell what you were taking the picture of without even looking at it, then it's not a good photo. So they want everybody shot at 1.2 with selective lighting, selective focus, and selective color. And I definitely admire the photographers who had the courage to hide their subjects and make the viewer work for it a little bit more.
No, it's great. And I think that just goes to show you that you're learning and you've learned about the history of photography and even art. I mean, have you delved into the master Dutch painters and started digging more into art itself, even more so than photography?
The Dutch masters are huge for me. Actually, one of the highlights of my young life was going to Amsterdam. Not for the reason why it's the highlight of most people's young lives, but because I got to go to the Rijk Museum and see Vermeer paintings in person, which was very, very important to me.
Pretty crazy when people see that in real. I mean, you can look at stuff in a book or on the web and it's like, oh, well, that's cool. Actually, if you think about the context, how these Vermeers were made and how they painted them and what they did and what was into it, it just blows your mind.
I think the same can be said in a sad way, true for photography now, though, is that the young generation, and I count myself among this, really lack an appreciation for physical manifestations of things. People don't care about prints anymore, and that's a crying shame because there's an art to printmaking, and a real physical print is a beautiful thing. People just have this idea that a print is just something that you can send off for, and they're all pretty much interchangeable, and they're not.
No, and I think that's why it's important that people study art and look at the stuff that you've learned and look how it's changed your attitude in regards to your photography.
Well, definitely. I mean, I fell in love with silver prints. It's funny, though, but it took me all that time to go full circle because that's what I loved before I ever picked up a camera.
Well, at least you've only spent money on a few digital cameras.
I don't mean to come off as anti-digital because I'm not. And I think that it really works for a lot of people's styles. I think that for many applications, I mean, certainly with my commercial work, for many applications, it would be impractical, given my clients' needs to shoot all film. But I think that certainly when I'm focused more on art, I feel that my artistic vision is more in line with what I capture on an analog medium.
Okay, so let's move into analog medium. So I know, and I just mentioned that you're shooting with a 1V or a 1VHS.
VHS I took off. I don't like the grip. It makes the camera too big.
The only thing I noticed about that, because I have two or three 1Vs and HS grips, and I've just noticed that with a big glass, like a 51-2 or an 85-1-2, without the grip on it, the camera tends to want to just nosedive down and it doesn't hang right on a strap. But
yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I remember one time I had the grip on the 1V and I was out and somebody approached me in public and said, "Man, that's a serious camera." I was like, okay, I never ever want to have this grip on again.
I get flack for that all the time. I take a camera on the plane and I always have a camera out. And I learned this from Jay Mazel, okay? You never leave the building without a camera. And if you're going to take it, you might as well take it. So if you're going to take your stuff, you got to take it and shoot it. And I've got that all the time with the 1B. I'd be like, whoa, look at that camera, dude. Whoa, you know, all the time. And I take a Leica or like a Best. I really like the Best rangefinder because with the right model, it's a one-to-one viewfinder. So you focus right eye as you're right-handed, but you can leave the left eye open. And when you're looking through the viewfinder, they're both 100%.
It's funny, I've been looking at 35mm rangefinders a lot over the last couple weeks. I've been trying to decide exactly which way to go to that, so it's interesting to hear you say that.
Best R3A, I mean, it's not as sexy as a Leica. It's not as polished, and it's a little rough. But the thing works, literally, with the R3A, you can shoot it 100% viewfinder, left eye, right eye open, and walk around, and it's a different experience. You don't feel like you're hiding behind a camera. And like you said, you get to see these things, and you can see, and you can perceive depth of fields, and it's definitely an experience. So I think that the whole deal with a big camera there. Well, big camera, you're an RZ guy.
Well, the RZ has its place for me, as I say, in the world of portraiture or in the world of very controlled situations. And as I say, I love the fact that it's a waist-level finder, and that's probably the single biggest selling point of the camera to me. It does produce beautiful negatives, and the big, beautiful negatives are wonderful. And the glass is great on the system. I spend a lot of time with the 110 2.8 on, which is a wonderful lens. I've also got the 180 and the 250 APO, all wonderful glass. It's a great camera system. But I spend a lot more time working with my Mamiya 7 rangefinder because, as I mentioned, I like smaller, lighter, faster, and that camera certainly fits those qualities for the most part.
Well, especially the 7. I mean, the glass in that thing will make your eyes bleed.
Oh, yeah. I heard somebody say that it was the closest thing to shooting large format without actually doing it. And in terms of just the pure resolution and the detail that you can squeeze out of those negatives. And I believe it. I mean, it's really unbelievable what I can get out of that camera, especially the 50mm lens on it is just blindingly sharp. And again, the joys of shooting a rangefinder is I'm sitting looking in my house at a 16x20-inch silver print that I shot at 1/15th of a second handheld, and the thing is unbelievably sharp. And that's something you'd have a hard time getting with an SLR at that kind of shutter speed.
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about this. So when you're doing wedding, you're doing editorial, documentary, photojournalistic, whatever you want to call it, and you're covering a nice, great wedding, and you're doing portraits, and it's lovey-dovey, what do you like to shoot with? What can you get away with? Because the 110-28 is the fastest piece of glass ever for an RB or an RZ. So,
and that's really what I'm using. For medium format at weddings, that's pretty much the lens and the camera when I go to the larger format. I get a lot of mileage out of the Canon 35mm systems, so that's where my bread and butter of most of the wedding coverage is. As I say, I'm a documentary photographer first and foremost when I'm shooting a wedding, and there's a reason why 35mm is the classic format of photojournalism. And I've got a whole arsenal of crazy expensive Canon glass. The Canon people must love me. but it's mostly that. And then I pull out the RZ for the portraits, and I pull out the RZ for more predictable situations. The bride is getting her dress buttoned up, and I know exactly where she's going to be, and she's going to have a hard time moving around anywhere very quickly. Then I might pull out the bigger camera for a couple of shots.
No Mamiya 7 at a wedding, then?
A little bit. The slower glass is tricky. Here in Nashville, I do mostly church weddings, and I do mostly indoor receptions. So the F4 is a little bit limiting for that kind of documentary where I have to be on the move a lot. So the Mamiya 7, mostly as far as weddings are concerned, I might pull it out for a wide-angle shot of a ceremony on a tripod or something like that, but not as much for the wedding.
Let's talk about emulsion. So you have this wide array and options of different kinds of film to shoot. What do you like for color, and what do you like for black and white?
I'm crazy about the new Portra, like most of the film wedding photography crowd. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. So that's really lately what I've been shooting. Then as far as black and white, it's funny. I understand the benefits of shooting one emulsion primarily, but I always keep on finding a reason to try to pick an emulsion that's specific to a task. I tend to prefer the classic emulsions over the T-grain stuff, but the T-grain stuff definitely has its place. I tend to shoot more Ilford than Kodak, but I do love Tri-X as far as black and white.
For portraiture, do you find that the T-grain films are too sharp?
Some of the portraiture is when I tend to pull out the T-grain films. I really like Delta 400 push 2-stops. I think Delta 400 at 1600 is a fantastic film that can give a very sort of film noirish kind of cinematic look that I think really works very well. And I also do like the fact that the T-grain films like Delta have a bit of extended red sensitivities, especially when I'm shooting women and I want a little bit of a more luminous skin tone. I can get that out of some of the more modern emulsions. But again, it really depends. Every time I think I hate a film and decide that I'm never going to shoot it again, I find something that makes me reconsider it. And I really think that we're lucky to live in an age where we still have, thank goodness, so many of these different films available. And I worry about the consolidation that seems to continue to happen, because it's nice to have so many options.
Sure. Do you soup your own stuff? Are you sending it off to a lab? And who are you using?
Both. For my personal work, I soup my own stuff in-house. And like for my current project, I'm mostly shooting Tri-X, and I'm mostly souping in X-Tol 1:1. But for most of my wedding work, I'm sending my stuff out to the wonderful folks at RPL, and they do a spectacular job on it for me. So very happy with what they've been doing. And all of my color stuff goes to them.
Pretty cool there. So back to your 1Vs. What's your favorite piece of glass on the Canon?
The 35-1.4. So that's my go-to lens. That's what I carry most of the time. It's a spectacular piece of glass and definitely gives me a lot of flexibility. When you start to get to the wider stuff, even the 1.4 isn't, depending on how close I am to the subject, so unbelievably shallow, but usually I'll be stopping it down a little bit if I have any ability to do so.
What about focusing? Are you a manual focus guy, autofocus? Have you changed the focus screen in that camera?
I'm an autofocus guy for the Canon stuff. I have pretty good eyes with my military marksmanship training and all, and certainly unless I wanted to change that screen out, I always feel that with the really critical focus on that system, it's harder to do it. It's so much easier to focus a rangefinder critically, manually, in my opinion. And like for the Mamiya stuff, the larger stuff, I certainly have got a split prism in there, and that helps me out a lot. But mostly I'm an autofocus guy on the Canon system, and I've had pretty good results with that. It's just sort of what I'm used to.
So Evan, let's talk about personal work here besides shooting commercial things and jewelry and beautiful women and all this stuff. You're actually working on some personal projects that I think is a necessity for a photographer to continue to grow and do these things. And right now you're doing a really cool series that has brought a lot of attention to yourself because our fine friends over at Mamiya posted some of your beautiful work up on their blog. Let's talk about this personal project, about shooting this Americana black and white nighttime long exposure, sort of really cool looking, basically little dive restaurants and drive-ins, and sort of this whole Americana food gig.
Well, I was ordered by my wife to come up with a personal project, which is something that I'd never really done in an organized way. I'd always shot personal work, but I'd never really had a project that organized and focused my efforts. So my wife told me one day that I needed a project and that I'd better figure out what I was going to do. So I sat down and I looked at it. As I mentioned earlier in the interview, I feel very strongly that the only thing that really can make a photographer special is having a clearly developed perspective. I think it was Adams who said that the only thing that matters is where you stand. And that's both literally and figuratively true. So I was looking for a subject matter for the project that I had strong opinions on, and something that I was passionate about, and something that interested me, and I had things that were worth saying. My wife and I are pretty hardcore foodies. My brother is a Michelin-starred chef up in Chicago at a spectacular restaurant called Sepia. He has exposed me over the years to all kinds of wonderful food, both the absolute highest ends of the spectrum and also at the sort of very dive bar, bare bones kind of eating that can also be a wonderful experience. And I have some pretty clearly developed opinions about the way Americans eat and American food culture, some of the things that maybe could be worked on and could be improved in the way our culture deals with food, some of the things that other cultures maybe do better than we do, and some of the things that are also wonderful, in many cases in danger of being lost, about American food culture. So I thought that that would be a very good subject matter for me. It was a rich subject matter that was really worth saying about. So I set out to start doing that. I drew a lot of inspiration. I've spent the past couple of years really studying Robert Frank's The Americans, and that's very high on my list of how I thought about structuring this project. But I've also spent a lot of time lately studying George Tice, particularly his urban landscape series, particularly some of his night shots that he's done of urban landscapes, definitely inform my work. Although his stuff is definitely more formal than mine, being shot very perspective corrected, large format, and so on. So with those things sort of firmly in mind, I set out and started walking around my neighborhood with the Mamiya 7 and a little Gitzo tripod, and started trying to capture things that I found interesting and cool, and hopefully had something that could relate to what other people felt about our food culture in this country.
So let's talk about the series. I mean, right now, what we've seen, and I don't know if this stuff is even actually up on your websites or anywhere.
I'm trying to figure out something to do for this series that'll be a more permanent home for it. I haven't really decided where it's going to live. Right now, I've been putting it up on the weddings blog, but just because it's the easiest thing for me to update.
So that's under the recent tab on your website, then?
Yes.
Okay, because I know that our friends over at Mamiya showed off a few photos. And are you starting the series off with these nighttime landscapes of these establishments? And where does this project move from there?
Well, what I'm looking at doing is I'm looking at trying to assess both individual restaurant, individual aspects, sort of the accoutrement of the way we eat. I'm trying to avoid shooting still lifes of the actual food itself. I feel that the danger of me being judgmental might come into play there. And I also feel like I would have a hard time making it fit in with the rest of the series. Now, if I started shooting still lifes of Big Macs, I feel like it would immediately go towards that Irving Penn still life style. And I just feel like it would be too jarringly disconnected from everything that I am looking for in the rest of the series. And I've also been trying to avoid, or at least be very careful about where I include individual people in the series. Anytime you start to get too many faces in the picture, it starts to personalize it in a way. And I want the series to be more universal than that. But I do want it to be very people-oriented, if that makes any sense. But some of the stuff I've been doing, working grocery stores, restaurants, coffee shops, I'm also looking at food suppliers. I'm interested in the food supply chain of how we get our food and how food gets from farms and farmers or processing facilities and so on onto our table, and trying to examine those with a combination. It's a difficult balance when you look at a project like this. I don't want it to be a judgmental, and I don't want to take pictures seeking to go out and criticize or elevate things too much. I just want to find subject matter about which I have an opinion and then take a picture and let whatever happens happen.
I'm sure I'm going to find that's going to be an interesting journey with this whole food thing, because it's really trippy, and I think any more in any Western country probably, but even more so in the U.S. about the whole process.
Well, I think to a certain extent, not to drag it back into the camera world, but I think that one of the sad things that you see in food, and one of the things that I deal with in the series, is the homogenization of the American food culture. And I see the same thing in the camera culture. I mean, one of the things that I see that's so sad is, I know WPPI is coming up, so weddings and portraits are very much on people's minds. And one of the reasons why I love film, but one of the things that I see is worrisome about the industry, is everybody is shooting the same blend of a little bit of documentary, a little bit of portraits and detail photos in roughly the same proportions. They're using one of two digital camera systems that are, for all intents and purposes, so close that it's splitting hairs to talk about differences between them. They're using the same software to process the images. They're using the same actions within that software in many cases. They're sending the images out to book companies that are all using the same printing processes, the same printers, and one of two different papers. And basically, at every step of the game, they're delivering roughly the same proportion of color in black and white. Every single possible place there is to make a choice, people are making the same choice. And in many cases, on any individual one of those choices, there's a very good reason for it. But in aggregate, what tends to happen is there's this hugely homogenous look to everything. And I think it's really unfortunate. And funny, I see actually the same thing in film on the wedding side. One thing that I think is sort of funny is, don't get me wrong, I have absolutely nothing against the contact system, for instance. But I think it's kind of comical that with all of the many wonderful cameras that are out there, that every single wedding photographer in the country now is trying to buy a Contax 645 system. So it's one of those things that once everybody sees one person doing something that's successful for them, everybody else wants to do exactly the same thing because they think that's their ticket to success. And it's when people can really blaze their own trail, that's when they can be really successful and hopefully find something that's going to be more meaningful to them and more lucrative. I mean, it's a wonderful camera, and there are a lot of very good practical reasons why it's a great camera system for wedding photographers, but, I mean, for goodness sakes, there are an awful lot of good systems out there. I mean, Mamiya makes a great 645 system that, incidentally, they're still very much in business and can support it. And Hasselblad makes some absolutely wonderful cameras. Why aren't wedding photographers shooting Blads anymore? All of the film people, anyway, are shooting contacts. And all of these different things and all of these different approaches, again, it's not so much that it matters about the finer points of an MTF curve of the lens or the finer details, but in many cases, shooting a square format is going to change the way you organize information versus shooting a 645 format. And the way you organize information in a frame is what's really going to make you good.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, but at least it seems to be there's an upsurge in more people wanting to use a tactile analog craft to make their art. And I think there is an upswing to a point that either people don't want to be so consumed with digital post-processing, or they want a tactile thing, or they want to have a niche. I mean, a lot of people might be going back to film just because they want a niche and it's going to make them stand out. I don't know.
Well, it's that, but again, the nice thing is that at least with film, you have more choices than just shooting one of two 35mm digital systems. You have all of these rangefinders and view cameras and waist level finders and all this wonderful stuff that you can do. You can shoot instant film, which is really cool. And there are all these different ways that you can go with it. So it's not just a question of shooting film versus digital, but it opens up a whole sea of choices once you are willing to accept the possibility of doing film. But really, getting back to what you're saying, I mean, I see the same thing. My wife, who is a director of brand intelligence for a company here in Nashville, she's far more talented and successful than I am, by the way. She comes home at the end of every day sitting in front of a computer and working on websites and working on social media and all this stuff. And all she wants to do is cook, or all she wants to do is sew. She does all of these different knitting and other tactile activities because in many cases feels like she spent all day doing this virtual stuff. And she wants that sense of physicality and realness in her life. And I think that's the same thing that we're seeing in photography. And I hope that we're going to see in general that people in many parts of our lives, and getting back to the food project, people have sacrificed the richness and texture of human experience on the altar of convenience. That's a really unfortunate trend, but one that I think we're starting to see be stemmed a little bit.
Well, hopefully, because the whole convenience thing, and I could go on to an hour rant about the whole food deal, but I don't know. I mean, I would rather go somewhere and experience the whole deal and spend an hour or two minimum and enjoy the whole process and just going somewhere and cramming it down and going on to the next worthless gig.
Well, that, and it's also a question of predictability. I mean, people these days are in many ways risk averse. They're afraid. One of the reasons why all of these chains and so on are so successful, one of the reasons why a very specific type of professional photography, whether on the retail or commercial side, is so successful right now, is that it's inherently very, very predictable. People know exactly what they're getting. I mean, I had a bride one time who told me she was concerned about the fact that I couldn't see what was on the back of the camera when I was shooting. She wants to know exactly what she's getting and have a very predictable product. And the thing about predictability is it's really antithetical to good art. Good art, to a certain extent, will always defy expectation a little bit. Because if it was what you expected, then it didn't force you to reconsider your perspective. And that's what good art does.
That just proves the point that 99% of the population has no idea what's good or bad. They just want predictable. The same thing Susie got is what Lisa wants, and the same thing Lisa got is what whoever wants. Everybody wants the same cookie cutter gig.
Well, that's true for most people, but I do think that there are people who are increasingly seeking out in all areas of life, whether in art or in food or in a variety of different areas, authenticity is what matters now. Look at music, for instance. You've reached a point where in the world of auto-tune and all of these other fancy post-production tools that musicians have available, pretty much anybody can record a song and make it sound good, regardless of talent level and everything else. The songs are written by committee in many cases, and it's just all very, very homogenized. And people are increasingly seeking out the richness and texture of live performance and going places and actually relating on a direct level. Really, the value of these homogenized media, yes, they're low cost to produce, but they've become so ubiquitous that they have almost no value anymore. I mean, when you can download songs illegally or you can just download them for so inexpensively, it's hard to place a lot of value on a recording that can just be easily copied and everything else. But it's a lot more easy to assign value to a real experience that you have of seeing somebody in person and seeing them perform. So I think that there is a subset of the population that's starting to wake up to the fact that there is more to life than just predictability and reliability and cheapness.
So with commercial work, weddings, portraits, the personal work, what are you looking forward to do that you haven't got to do yet? What's your focal point on something that you want to do with your photography and your business?
Well, my real goal right now is I'd like to develop this project into perhaps first some kind of gallery showing, which I've never done. I've always been very much a commercial photographer and never really touched on sort of the fine art world. So I'm very excited to be doing this just mostly for myself and as an opportunity to express myself, but also possibly to be getting involved in that. But I'm also looking very much to this shelf of books that I have. And I'd love to be able to develop the series into something that was more than the sum of its parts. Again, I hate to keep on harping on Frank, but I've spent so much time studying the Americans. And it's fascinating to look at how that series of photos is more than the sum of its parts. There is so much layering, not just in the individual photos, but in the way he sequenced them. That's tremendously important to the function of that book. That level of intellectual rigor that he applied to putting that collection of images together is something that inspires me every time I look at it. And even though I certainly don't consider myself even a tenth of the photographer he was, that's the standard to which I aspire.
Well, you got to set your levels high, right?
Yeah, shoot for the moon.
That's it. So, Evan, let's talk about where people can go find your wedding portrait. They can look at their personal project, your commercial work. Where can they go see this fabulous photography? And one thing that I want to note, too, is, and I don't know if it's because you're in the South, but I love the formal bridal portraiture. It's beautiful.
Thank you very much, by the way. It's something that we do here in the South that seems to be very unique to this part of the country, although I'm always surprised that my colleagues in other parts of the country have such a hard time selling it. Because the girls love it. It's a dress rehearsal, no pun intended, for their wedding, so they know exactly how everything's going to look. And it just gives us time to really make sure we nail that perfect image. And then they get to display it on their wedding day. So it's something that we do here, and I'm always surprised. It seems like it's a pretty easy sale here. But that's just because it's very integrated into our culture. But it's a wonderful thing to be able to do, and I really enjoy that. The wedding's website is evanbaines.com. Also, on the recent tab, that is the current home of the personal project, the How We Eat project as well, although I may be finding a more permanent home in time for that. And then the commercial website is BainesPhoto.com.
This is great stuff, beautiful photography, and I do appreciate it that you join us today, Evan, to talk about your photography, this work, the influence of art in your work, and all this great background you have. This is really cool stuff, and I do appreciate it. And we definitely look forward to chatting again on some other topics because, like I said, this is good stuff and a very unique perspective that a lot of photographers don't have. So I think fabulous stuff, buddy. Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, there you go. Evan Baines. What a great guy. Beautiful photography. But, you know, his enthusiasm, his outlook, his knowledge base. You know, he hasn't been doing this a million years. The guy's only like 30 years old or something. He has inspiration and knowledge beyond his years. He's really grasped the whole photography deal and hasn't worried about who's shooting what or who's got the latest what, and really dove into his own gig and studied the past masters, the current masters, and really took a grasp and look about composition and editing and camera. There's a lot of stuff that you can learn just by looking at Evan's photography. It's great stuff. Definitely check out his website, look at his work. We look forward to having Evan back on the program to talk some more about photography, art, and all the great things that he's up to. The Inside Analog Photo Radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film, and of course, fine quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends at Photo Publicist, worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the finest quality lab in the country, richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. Upstrap for the finest quality camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder at upstrap-pro.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios at igerstudios.com. And, of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House, over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shippard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.